From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's not very often you have a guy who's gone from working with Stephen Sondheim to Keanu Reeves in the same career. And my guest, Ian McShane, is just that person. The Last of Sheila is one of his many films, and he's got many films out this year. John Wick Chapter 3, Parabellum is one, and the film we're going to talk about today, of course, is Bolden, in which he uses the word oppressor in a way I've never heard before. So, Ian, so good to have you here.
It's good to be here, Elvis. Nice to see you.
And I was really struck by this because we were talking a little bit about the film. The film really is like going inside of a man's psychosis and trying to get his hands around what it is that's really his creative force, that person being Buddy Bolden.
Dan Pritzker sent me it was a very dense script. About, when would we do it? About 4 years ago, and then three. I kept going back and doing reshoots because Dan wanted to make it his, you know, it's his personal passion and it's his movie. I mean, he put up the money for the whole thing. I mean, he filmed it once before in 2008.
Yeah, you were telling me about that.
But he wasn't happy with it. So he said, I'll make it again. But he kept some amazing things. And it's one of those movies that, because he's a musician himself, Pritzker, he had his avant-garde rock band for like 20 years, still has, on and off. And I'd never heard of this, but he said, well, Buddy Bolden, and
when she said Buddy Bolden was really ground zero for jazz.
Well, he was, yeah, but I was sort of one of those names. And then I read this book by the beautiful prose poem by Michael Ondaatje, Coming Through Slaughter. And this isn't based on that at all, but...
But it feels in a lot of ways like that.
Well, because it's like a fever dream. It's like a visual set piece, I think a visual companion piece to Ondaatje's book, in that Dan found a way... And it was an interesting film to make because we made it in Wilmington and Atlanta and New Orleans. Sadly, I never got to go there. That's one place I'd never be. I'd love to go, but all my stuff was down there. But what he wanted to make was a film about jazz and a man who nobody really knows much about. I mean, Armstrong said that he heard him play once. That might be apocryphal. But nevertheless... adds to the film. I mean, the Marseillaise score is great, you know what I mean? It's
phenomenal. He just put out a playlist of all the songs that that influenced what he was doing in the movie. It's really beautiful.
No, well, it's extraordinary. And, you know, I haven't listened to that kind of music for a long time, you know. And it takes you back, and it takes you, you know, when I was growing up. Now, my dad was an eclectic collector of music, so I grew up with a lot of that and a lot of other stuff. And to work with a young... mostly unknown black cast was kind of thrilling in a way to put yourself in another environment completely. Of course, I was playing the oppressor, the mythical Leland Perry, which is based on kind of a guy who was mayor of New Orleans later was Perez. But this is sort of going back. And we talked about it for a while because you have to have, Bolden sometimes has to have a sort of an antagonist to work against. But when I saw the movie, and I was actually quite thrilled because we made it in some ways as a conventional movie. There were conventional scenes the whole time. And it was on the nose about me, you know, making him as the, you know, the white judge who infiltrates the black community with picking out the largest black people to fight each other for the benefit of the white population and then distributes drugs. He's himself a drug addict. And finds himself, you know, abusing all the young, you know.
But also sits in judgment on Buddy.
And even though they've never met. But when I saw the movie, I was thrilled that actually he took away those real scenes in terms of like, and made it fragmentary. And you have to see, and he took the point of view from Bolden's point of view. You have to see this guy who's, you know, was obviously hugely talented, but had the classic life of, you know, an alcoholic, a womanizer, and by... bipolar or whatever he was. I mean, he was certified as crazy at the time. And then, of course, my character puts the stamp on him and puts him inside in the lunatic asylum and then burns or gets rid of the only living example of his art, which is the music, because there's still no
recordings.
There's no recording, no. So you have to make up some of that to make the film work. And I was, you know, people, you know, who'd seen it sort of were like, perplexed a little by it. It's a difficult film. I said, no, It's actually how I read what I'm working with Dan on the movie, how he finally found a way to make the movie he wanted, which is like a fevered dream from Bolden's point of view, with this amazing music and some quite remarkable stuff I think he shot with some surrealistic stuff in it, which is great. And I was really blown away. I mean, Dan said to me about 2 months ago, because I've been busy going back and forth with John Wick PR stuff and then American Gods stuff, and he said to me, can I send you the... And I did some ADR on it, finished it finally, I think, earlier this year. And he said, can I send you a link? I said, I'd love to, yeah. So he sent me a link, and I said, well, you know, I'll watch a bit of it on the iPhone. I make sure I got the link. And an hour and 20 minutes later, I watched the whole thing on the iPhone. That's just a good sign. You know, I was just completely thought, this is the film he wanted to make, and it's nice to be a part of it in this sort of abstract way, because he doesn't tell a conventional tale. He tells a tale through the eyes of somebody, but all the time you get... I understood it. I mean, what did you think? It's sort of had, and it's received very sort of little publicity, but I think it's a really interesting seminal work from somebody who has great respect for the project and for his, you know, for where he places Bolden, but at the same time, makes a really interesting movie.
It's funny because I was thinking about that W.H. Auden essay, Enchantment, and he says, to live in enchantment is to live in a state of certainty. And Buddy's looking for that enchantment, which we see in him from time to time. But also there's that kind of terrifying enchantment because your character enters by voice first.
Yeah.
And we hear that power and that certainty that he has. I mean, and it's these guys being transported by drugs.
You will not get above your place. You will not get above your station, son. I mean, that's it. But it's he did it in the, I think, the fact that the way I viewed the movie, and it's interesting, when you're making it, we did a lot of conventional scenes, and then we do some extra stuff, we take sessions off for specialized little scenes in a surreal way, like, you take, can you do this, when they set the lighting, whatever, so, and I thought, that's, you know, I've got a feeling all some of this conventional stuff won't be in the movie, and thank God it wasn't.
You knew that in a shoot.
I had a feeling, because Dan talked all the time about wanting to make a movie that, I think, as he made the more material, he finally decided what he wanted to do with it. And I was, as I said, when I watched, I was like, oh, yeah, I could, you know, I really. And to make I think it's very brave to make, even though it's his own money, it's bought and paid for by Mr. Pritzker himself, so he can do what the hell he wants. But to go out there and make that, and I was deeply impressed by Gary's performance as Buddy Bolden, and all the other, Eric, Gary, a lot of the kids who played the parts, and it was a fascinating time to be around, and I remember it was really interesting the first time I went down there, because it was at the time of the Michael Brown shooting.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so that's like 4 years ago, yeah, and it was... You know, and if you've never worked, I mean, because it is a 95% black cast, you know, a black crew, and working there, and it was a really, you know, and the subject matter you're making, and me being English, writing in a different way, not American, it was an interesting time. And, well, still is. I mean, it's
interesting because being there at the time of the Michael Brown shooting, you actually see how much that oppression has not changed.
Oh, absolutely. And since in the political climate we live in now, which is not very healthy for anybody, you know, for any immigrant or whatever.
Well, I've been waiting for a film about this guy for a long time.
You have? I have. Well, that's great.
And it's a great film, by the way. You may recognize the voice of the man sitting across from me as Ian McShane. One of his many new films in release is Bolden, the story of Buddy Bolden. And what's interesting, too, and your character really kind of epitomizes that, is the presences we feel in his psyche. I mean, so many things that aren't seen but felt.
Exactly. They don't have to be. I mean, that's what I meant when I said I saw the film and I was in tune with it. I mean, your agents see it, people see him before me, they go, oh, of course, there's not enough of you in the film. And I think there's just enough, actually. It's absolutely fine because it's not the story of press. You get enough of that to know what he means psychologically to Bolden. He doesn't have to appear. They don't have to have scenes together. They're those extraordinary things when they... And we did some sort of... extraordinary shooting from refractions of light inside the prison on me, and then reflected on him and me going, I mean, sort of, what do you call it? Like a it was like a kaleidoscope thing, reflected in a way so I would come onto it. Now, I mean, it was a really interesting film to make, and Dan was passionate about it. And when I saw it, I was just, I'm so glad you like it, because I thought, oh, yeah, that's the film he wanted. And that's the film I wanted to see. I didn't know what film I wanted to see, but I knew that it was, when I saw it, it was like saying, oh, yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that, but he did a brilliant job in the edit and bringing everything together. And I said he made it before in 2008 and didn't like it, but he kept some of the stuff from them, like the Alvin Ailey dances in the forest.
But he must have realized, as he made the earlier version, that it had to be about this kind of fragmentation of his psyche.
He did, but he still was, you know, still, I think, was making a regular film, but only over the course of seeing all the material he had. He took his time with it. Did it come to him? How to make a movie. I mean, I remember this years ago and what's wonderful about filmmaking, when we did Sexy Beast, right, which is a really good movie, I can say that, not many, but it's a really, really smart movie. It all starts with a script. But at the end of it, I remember, I saw a cut of it with Ray and I went to it, and the director, and he'd done what a lot of directors do, and believe me, he was terrific, Jonathan. He did a lot of great work.
But he did
a thing like the first cut, and he'd juxtaposed a lot of the stuff in it. And you looked at it and you thought, it's okay, it's fine, it's his. And then he went back to the original script, his idea, and you thought, and he put back in all the stuff about the crazy, you know, the sexy beast, the mad rabbit walking across the desert and all that. And it worked. And then I thought, and then it just reminded me when I saw Bolton, I thought, yeah, Dan was actually able to see all that other stuff and then cut through it and go back to his original thought, which was to make a film about this guy, Buddy Bolden, from Bolden's point of view. But he was making a regular film, and somehow he managed to cut through and eliminate a lot of the regular stuff that was in it and make this fevered dream of a movie with all this amazing music.
Well, one of the things it does that you want a movie like this to do is basically to leave as many questions unanswered as it does answered. And it's because it's finally about a guy who's unknowable even to himself.
Nothing exists of him except, you know, Ondaatje's book and now this film. And people, you know, and secondhand stories which have been passed down, lore of what he played like and what he sounded like, what he was. But, you know, you can't ignore that. I mean, you do know this guy must have been something special.
Well, it's like that great scene in it when he's tells the band to put down all their instruments, and he tells everybody to count it out. And you can see how that influence still lives in contemporary terms of music.
I think it's a musician's movie too, in some ways. You know what I mean? I think they'll appreciate that the sort of, and the joy of the music comes through. The joy of that music, the joy of his playing, and compared to the pain of his normal life.
And the burden of that talent, which is really what it's about, too. I mean, just have this thing that can't be expressed in ways that make sense to anybody. All these women he's seeing, they say, well, you're not going to go anywhere, and you're going to. And one of his closest friends said, you're playing music that's not written down, so it's not going to live after you're gone, which sadly turns out to be a really prophetic statement, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, how do we get, you know, it's like life snatches away from us all the time. Important talents or whatever.
We're going to take a break. My guest, who's not easily impressed, likes his new movie, Bolden. It's Ian McShane. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. I'm thrilled to be sitting across from my guest, Ian McShane, who's in more movies right now than I know anybody could even make. One of them happens to be Bolden, the story of Buddy Bolden. It's The Treatment, by the way. And what I want to ask you about, too, is the way he enunciates. Basically, everything, every utterance sounds like he's passing down sentence in some ways. You know what I mean? Like he's making a judgment about something, your character.
Well, my character. That was kind of – I mean, if you're going to – as I said, we played some ordinary scenes, and it was very affecting. I mean, sometimes, you know, we filmed in this house in Atlanta, which has all these amazing sort of stained glass windows of the black experience in the 19th century, which isn't too great, you know what I mean?
But tell me about it.
It really comes home to you when you're doing it and you're making these comments about, you know, and Dan had deliberately written down, like, you know, look how happy y'all were there, picking cotton, and my man Jefferson Davis. But you see, great, you didn't have that in the movie at the end. You didn't need that. All you needed was other stuff, fragmented from that. But it got me at the time because you're working on a film like that. I mean, I did the original Roots. You know, that's interesting, working on, a seminal show, which was, you know, about a period in our history, which, you know.
I got to ask you, because you've, between Roots and Bolden, and even to some extent, Deadwood, you've done a number of pieces about American tragedy, about the tragic repercussions of American history and people taking things that don't really belong to them. And I just wonder, is that something that really excites you about doing these things sometimes? Because you've done a number of pieces like this.
Social commentary is difficult. I mean, but the way it's told is that it's important. It's like the way that Milch told or talked about it in Deadwood, I thought was always one of those extraordinary pieces to have your main black character, if you like, the blacksmith, kill himself, commit suicide. It was like, Jesus, David. And then to have the guy that really causes it be kicked by a horse and be driven round by the N-word general for the rest of the movie. And then to do Roots, which was like, you know, to be part of that, which at the time, I mean, it was a long time ago, 76.
Yeah, it came out in 77.
I must say, there were a few tensions on the set, yeah. I mean, we made it in 76, I think. Yeah, it was made then, 76. It was a big, I mean, and the reason I did it, because I'd done a movie before with the company, with David Walper's company, who was always a little step ahead of the game, David. You know, they'd done all the documentaries. It became a big documentary about it. And they took a chance on doing that Alex Haley book. But that was a huge step forward for American television. I mean, huge, you think about it. Now it's like, and they remade it, like, didn't they, 2 years
ago? Yeah, a couple of years ago.
I mean, why the hell they did that, I don't know. But it's kind of like, no, they'll reinvent. But, I mean, it was such a breakthrough event at the time. And you continue to do it. I mean, yeah, it's nice to be part of that. And when he sent me the script for this movie, again, it was interesting being in a film and working with it in a different environment with a lot of, as I said to you, and working with a young black English actor playing an American.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is, as a student of history, and I know you to be this, it must be really fascinating to you to get a chance to live this stuff out and tell these stories that should be told and often are ignored in the entertainment industry.
Oh, well, yeah, the entertainment industry reinvents itself and lies to itself constantly. We all know that the whole time, you know, and whatever. It's like, you know, when we did, like Hellboy came out about a month ago, and everybody's going on, you know, not that I'm on the phone, they go, it's tracking marvelous, tracking great, it's going to be great, it's going to be wonderful. Then it comes out, and there's a backlash against it, but it sort of, it goes away, and nobody mentions it, nobody talks about it again. Except today, somebody sent me, and this I thought was great, somebody sent for me, and this explains a lot about this country again. Somebody said, you'll love this. A cinema chain in Tennessee, right, is showing, like, Avengers. Avengers, 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 Endgame, Avengers, Heck Boy. Because the woman that owns the cinema is religious, and it's opposite a church, and she would say, I've never had profanity on my marquee. So it's Heck Boy.
Well, let's hope she never sees... Maybe
she should have called it Heck Boy.
Maybe she shouldn't see the movie then. If she has trouble with the title, I can't wait till she sees the film
itself. Presenting Heck Boy.
It's the treatment. You're listening to the star of Heck Boy, Ian McShane. That's one of his many new films. And let's talk a little bit about, if we could, in the time you got left here, John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum, because you've moved on. And we get a chance to really see what Winston's about in his way, that he is. And this fits into what we're talking about here, because a man who's trying to maintain some sense of honor. And in a business that prides itself on this weird sense, this weird code of conduct that's quite ruthless, he's a person who's saying, you can't have honor without heart.
Absolutely. And also you're saying that, you know, even though we exist on rules and rules are what we live by, that occasionally, like the law is an ass, we all know that. And occasionally you have to break some stupid rules. So the fact that Fishburne gives John Wick a weapon, I give him an hour. And then the high table comes back and says, oh, you can't do it. It's like saying, really? You're going to try and take my hotel away from me? I don't think so. So it all shifts around. But I think in John, it works pretty well. I mean, the great thing was, we originally when we went to do John Wick, it was like, all come to New York, have a good time for 2 weeks, all great character actors. You know, you got Defoe, you had Leguizamo, you had me, you had...
Lance Reddick.
Yeah, Lance. Oh, Lance is great. But, you know, Lance and I at least have something to do in this together. Before, everybody thinks we've met. I said, no, we actually, in this film, we meet. And Lance and I all up, but we both have our backstories. I always say to him, I said, I think I was a spook for the MI6 in Africa in the early 60s and found you. Smart. I said, we've worked together ever since. He said, well, I have a different one. I said, but it's basically the same. And he said, it is. But that's great, though, but you invent this story that they've got each other's back, you know, because he plays it, Lance, and plays it with it. He plays a Kenyan, which I always go back to. I said, well, there you go. You come back to Jomo Kenyatta. You go back to the English colonial rule, you know, in Africa. I said, that's what I go back to. I said, maybe my character had a change of heart. And now we find ourselves, but we are, like, solid, him and me. And Lance in this one gets to do a bit of action, which I was pissed off. I said, have they kept that scene where I did my naked jiu-jitsu capoeira Brazilian style in the room on my own? And he said, yeah, they cut it. I said,
I lied.
I never did
that. That's for the DVD extras, I think. But it's interesting you're talking about this with Winston, because I've often wondered, and I'm glad you gave me a chance to ask this, because I even think about it in watching American Gods. If you give your characters, in addition to the kind of emotional backstory, a kind of a political backstory, so we know who, because we always know where your characters stand.
Well, I think you have to, or with the imagination that they can always shift on a dime, too. Like, I mean, you know, Wednesday, who is really Odin, if you like, but also at the same time is just as capricious as the new gods. I mean, he'll more so, but you'll have a better time with him, and he's playing a double game. But also he's setting, you know, again, it's interesting that I'm working with Ricky Whittle and I. You know, Ricky is terrific to work with, and his character, I think, will be more proactive in season 3. But as the cipher is written in the book, I mean, the shadow is written that way in the book. He's constantly asking, you know, who am I? Right? Who am I? What am I doing? But I think we've breadcrumbed it in at the end of episode 2 to leave him. I mean, the last episode went out the other night and leaves, you know, Shadow with the two great questions. He knows now that I'm his dad, and he knows now that I arranged for the death of his wife, in a sense. But, and you know for a fact, if he says to Wednesday, you know, by the way, you know, my dad, and Wednesday says, you never guessed that? That would be Wednesday. You never knew that? You as dumb as that? You as dumb as a rock? Like, you never realized that I am your dad? Oh, come on, give me a break. I mean, he'll constantly try and put him off guard, and that's some of their relationship. But then we're building to whereby Shadow has to take responsibility for his own, if you like, ascent to godness, if that's going to happen. And it will happen, because that's what it's all been prepared about.
Because it's interesting, too, that especially in the last few years, you played so many characters, Swearingen and Wednesday and the mayor here, who basically are characters who other characters kind of measure themselves against. You know what I mean? I mean, they're characters who exist as kind of these sort of impudent authority figures who are kind of playful with power because they know the power they have. And I wonder if there's something about that you like.
Enormously. But I also like if you have got great writers, and I've got to say that Milch is a great writer. I mean, in Deadwood, we talked about it briefly, but the fact that he gave, and basically I'm playing Milch, as a Swearingen, but never before quite so strongly as the two-hour movie. But the fact that Milch, who is so smart to work with, I mean, and the fact that he gave the parrot power, but then not too much power. He'd say to me, I'm not going to have you come down every week and slit somebody's throat and, you know, make a long speech about life and death. Well, I said, no, that's regular TV. What he does is, when he brings in Hearst, the Hearst figure, which is important, then that's real power, man. It's real power. Now, how do you deal with that? Because, you know, you'll be blown away.
Because I was saying to you before that one of the things that's interesting when he meets Hearst for the first time, he takes him up to stairs to the second floor. It's the first time we see Swearingen, the only time, actually, we see him on the second floor where he's not in command of the city.
Welcome, and he goes, this over, you know, the over-welcoming whatever. And, well, it's David's great line about drama, which is a lie agreed upon. You agree upon a lie with each. You don't have to talk about it, but you know, you both know you're not going to go to that place that you both know exists. So you'll talk around it, whatever, and you'll have all this false bonhomie about, hey, I'm a guardian pound, Mr. Swearman, and they walk out, and you know there's going to come a reckoning, which is what drama's about, and that's why he's a great dramatist.
It's funny because you use the word reckoning, and so many of these things you've done again in the last 10 years or so have been about these constant reckonings. It's been almost a kind of an Old Testament sense of these things. I mean, certainly Bolden feels like that, you know? I mean, it's almost the Garden of Earthly Delights, isn't it?
Wow, I've seen that in real. I've seen that for real at the Prada. It's extraordinary.
That's why I brought it up.
I know. But then you walk into the end there, and I was there, and it was like, we're looking at the Bosch, and then you go to Picasso, and then you come into Goya's black paintings. And that's when he's blown away, because that's what realizing man. And that's when, in his old age, Goya Robin, who's nearly, when he lived on the border in Bordeaux, and he painted this about what man's inhumanity to man. And that's where we're all leading towards. I mean, in a bit, you like to think you're doing, you know, a bit of art, and that's what it leads to. And we're not, you know, we're very cruel people. We really are, to each other.
Because it begs the question, because, again, so many of these characters you played in the last few years have been these sort of authority figures who are playful about it, as I've said before, and playful with power, but these guys who also finally are people who in some ways are these vestiges of the past. They're almost watching the world change around them, and I wonder if that's something you like playing to, these guys who are watching the world.
I think that's what I am. I mean, I think that's what we are. As you get an actor and you get older, and you realize, yeah, you're going through it. I mean, I look around now and it's like, wow, the world has changed. It's like getting older. You suddenly go, I'm old. Then I what? No, and it happens. It's like anything. It suddenly happens. It's like when you're getting better from an illness and suddenly you go, I couldn't have eaten that a week ago or whatever. And suddenly and it's forgotten about what you went through. It's like that. It's like, where did all that go to getting to this point? And now when you realize the world is in a really weird state. I mean, with everything. I mean, Venezuela now. That's hilarious, you know, trying to blame CIA, stay out of South America, would you? Monroe Doctrine, go to hell, thank you. But you know as well as I know, you know, that's all combined with that. Saying that, oh yeah, Guaido is the new, he's the new nothing. Can you believe a country that's got more, the second biggest oil resources in the world next to Saudi Arabia, and they're trying to say, and this hasn't been fomented by Western powers, you know that. And Putin's there trying to prop up Venezuela. Meantime, we've got our guy here, his best pals with Putin. What is, you tell me what's going on, Elvis.
Nobody's ever turned to me for that question. We're out of time. First of all, Ian McShane, you're welcome back here. Anytime you want to come, please come back.
It's always a pleasure to see you, my friend. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Leo DeLagula. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. Someone thinks the CIA listens to the show. Poor
I
fellow.
I hope they do. They
better not. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes with The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.